Well, good evening. We have a lot to cover in this first half. Thank you so much for being here this evening. The Jesus, once again, that we find in the Jesus story of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is not as domesticated or conventional as we have made him out to be. We're going to see that tonight. Jesus, the Jesus we find there, we do not see him traversing the countryside, trying to get a group of people to say a special prayer so that they can go to heaven when they die. Rather, he's looking for a group of people. He's inviting people to be a part of something, a revolution that he calls the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. It's a new way of doing life. Where did we say this week? Here. It's a new way of doing life now. It does lead to a brighter tomorrow. Jesus is giving us a way to heal the world. And at the very core of Jesus' ethical teachings is the way of peace. In Matthew 5, 38 through 44, Jesus said, "You have heard that it was said, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not," what does it say? "Resist an evil person." Now, I'm going to challenge that translation, "do not resist." From the beginning of the English translations, especially if you go back to the 1611 King James Version, "resist" has been the most popular word chosen to translate the Greek word anthistomai into. Let me just give you a little bit of context. If you were the king at that moment, at that time, and you were wanting to continue your oppressive rule, and you were authorizing a translation of the Bible, which is what the King James Version is, would you have wanted those who valued this book to hear Jesus say, "If you see evil, do not resist it"? Would you, as the king, have wanted to encourage non-resistance? How many can see that? Would you have done that? Let me see your hands if you would have been pushing in that direction. I'm going to challenge that tonight and share with you why I feel that resistance, that the lack of resistance, is the worst way to interpret this Greek word. Again, the Greek word is anthistomai. It's in your notes section there. It comes from two Greek words, anti and histomai. Now, histomai, I don't want to lose you, is the verb form of the noun stasis. In other words, the word is stasis, but stasis is the noun form of it. Histomai is the verb form of it. It's like running is a noun, but to run is a verb. Stasis is translated as violent rebellion, armed revolt, sharp dissension. In the Septuagint, which you don't need to remember that word, that's just the Greek version of the Old Testament, it's used 71 times, and 44 out of those 71 times, it is used primarily for a military encounter. It's the moment when two armies collide, steel on steel, until one side breaks and the other flees. It is the concept of returning like for like. Think of the context that Jesus is talking in. He says, "I know you've heard eye for an, tooth for a tooth." He's saying, but what I'm saying is do not something. In other words, don't return like for like. What do we call it? What is an English word that we could use tonight that refers to when someone does something to you, you do the same thing back to them? What's retaliation? That's it. To retaliate. Jesus is saying, do not retaliate against an evil person. But that's very different than resisting an evil person. How many would agree with that tonight? You see, Jesus is not teaching non-resistance. I want to put three words on the screen tonight as well. The first one is passive ism. And if you're listening to this by podcast, we're spelling that P-A-S-S-I-V-E-I-S-M. The other word is violence. I'm going to suggest to you that Jesus taught neither one of these two. He taught a third way, a middle option. Now, would it have been important to you, once again, as the king, to hear resistance? Be passive when you see evil. Would that have been important to you as the king? Yes, because was he practicing things that should have been resisted? Absolutely. But Jesus, once again, is not teaching passivism. Matter of fact, it doesn't even make sense to define it that way, because did Jesus spend his life resisting evil? Yes. Now, did he do it violently? No. But was he passive in regards to violence? No, to evil, no. So he's not saying be passive. Matter of fact, if you look there in your notes section again, numerous versions of this passage, one of them being the scholar's version, they translate this verse to say, do not retaliate against violence with violence. Do not strike back at evil. Do not react violently against the one who is evil. And then Jesus actually gives us three examples for him to illustrate exactly what he's talking about so that we don't miss the point. He said, if anyone slaps you on the what? Talk to me now. I know it's Friday night, and most of you don't have anything better to do this evening, but I do want to try to get you out of here at 8:30. So if someone strikes you on which cheek? Notice he does not say the left, he says the... Don't miss the details. It says, then turn to them the other cheek also. Now, I'm going to need a volunteer for this from the audience, and I'm not going to embarrass you, but I need your help. Is there anyone here this evening that would volunteer for me tonight, that would come up here and help me out with this? And okay, thank you so much. In the green there in the front. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Come on up. What is your name again?
Jason.
Everybody give Jason a round of applause. Thank you so much, Jason. Now, one of the things we have to understand is in the culture in which Jesus said this, you can see this in the Dead Sea Scrolls there in your notes section again, to even gesture to someone with your left hand carried a penalty and 10 days penance. Now, anyone who's been to a developing country, what do they don't have indoor plumbing. What do they do with their left hand? And don't be graphic. Wipe. That's a good way to say it. Yes. You don't do anything with your left hand publicly. You don't eat, serve food. You don't touch people. Your left hand is off limits. Everything you do with your right hand. So much so that in this culture, if you even waved at someone with your left hand, that carried a 10-day penalty. Are you with me so far? So he's got to take his left hand. Let's put it behind your back. Thank you so much. And then I want you to take your right hand, and I want him to strike me on which cheek? He has to use his right hand and strike me on my right cheek. So go ahead and do that. Use your right hand. All right. Did you see that? Thank you so much. Give him a hand. Thank you so much for your help. Did you see how he did that? Now, he did it in a kind of a non-conventional way. It wasn't the most ergodynamic way of doing it. If you're going to strike, but thank you, you did it right. Thank you. If you're going to slap someone with your right hand on their right cheek, how would you do it? It would be a backhanded slap. Now, this is significant. This would have meant something to people in Jesus' culture that day when he was saying this. You see, an equal, you would have struck them with a closed fist. You would have struck them on, but with a closed fist swinging this way, which cheek would that have landed on? Their left cheek. That is how you would have hit an equal once again. If you were going to strike someone who you considered to be your inferior, you would not strike them with a closed fist on your left cheek. You would strike them with your right hand, open-handed, backhandedly on their right cheek. That is the way a master would have struck a slave. That is a way, forgive me, this is first century, not 21st century. It's the way an adult would have struck a child. It's the way a man would have, in that culture, struck a woman. And Jesus is not saying, be a doormat. What Jesus is saying is, if they strike you on the right cheek, then you stand there, and what do? Do you hit them back? Would that be eye for eye? Would that be retaliation? But he says, don't be a doormat either. You stand there and stand up for the value that God has invested in you, and you offer them the cheek they are unwilling to strike. And you say, if you're going to hit me, fine, hit me, but you're going to strike me as your equal. Now, would they have done that? Probably not. That would have carried a fine as well to hit an inferior like an equal. Matter of fact, if you hit an equal as an inferior, you got penalized also. So it's very, we have to understand the cultural context of this. But how many of you so far, let me see your hands, how many of you so far can see the cultural significance of what Jesus is saying? He's saying, if you're going to strike me, fine, but I'm not going to allow you to dehumanize me of the value that God has given me. This is not pacifism. If you can see that, say yes. Nor is it violence. If you can see that, say yes. See, what Jesus actually taught was nonviolent non-cooperation. Say that with me. Nonviolent non-cooperation. Is this person cooperating with the dehumanization? No, he's resisting, but is he resisting violently? No. So it's nonviolent non-cooperation. It's what some today call passive. It's pacifism. That is a radically different word because, let me rewrite it because that's awful. You can't even read that. We've got pacifism on the top. We've got violence in the bottom, and in the middle, we have pacifism. But I want to be very clear. The most common mistake that people make when it comes to that middle term is they phonetically confuse it with the top term. How many have ever done that before? See, pacifism, true pacifism, comes from the Latin root, which is the Latin for what word? Peace. In other words, it's about doing something to produce change by a peaceful means. Martin Luther King stated that the goal to which we are trying to accomplish must be in harmony with the means whereby which we are trying to accomplish it. In other words, it's peace by peaceful means. It is not peace a la Martin or Malcolm X, which was peace by violent means. Do you understand the difference between those two? But it's still not passive. If you can see that, say yes. Look at John 18, 30. Oh, no, sorry. We're not moving ahead yet. We're not done with this. It says, and this one's even more radical. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your shirt, hand over your coat as well. There is a lot lost in the translation here. Shirt and coat, not good words to use. Those are articles of clothing that are used very differently than the way we use articles of clothing today. You see, he's talking about this garment that the Greeks wore that was kind of a mini skirt. It was one piece, short sleeve, mini skirt. Both men and women wore them. How many of you have seen pictures of those before? Maybe you've seen how they used to dress. That was called the chiton. Everybody say that with me, the chiton. Now the hemation, everyone say that word with me, hemation, say it with me, hemation. The hemation was a sash that you would wear over your chiton. Now, men could wear just the chiton, the undergarment, by itself. And you've seen little Greek dudes running around in their white, you know, they got a rope tied around it, but they're in their little white mini skirt, but it's a whole dress, kind of like short. How many, you know what I'm talking about? Some of you look at me like you have no idea what I'm talking about. You've seen those pictures, I'm sure you have. And then, but you could also wear the hemation over the top of it. And that hemation was kind of like what we always see Jesus wearing in the pictures. Remember, he had that undergarment, but then he had the sash over top of it. A man could actually wear that hemation also just by itself. So a man could wear the chiton, the man could wear the hemation. You've seen pictures of them with a sash, but their chest is still bare, even though there's something a sash draped over them. So they could wear that by themselves, or they could wear it together. Women, it was the same term for the female garment, they could wear the chiton, the undergarment, by itself. They could wear the hemation over top of the chiton, but women could not wear the hemation all by itself. They considered that to be immodest. You have the female version in Luke. We're going to be focusing on the male version here in Matthew. Jesus is saying, if they want to sue you for your chiton, your undergarment, then you give them your hemation as well. Now, what's he doing here? In this culture, an impoverished individual who is an indentured slave, basically, who for survival must borrow money from the wealthy, they were allowed to use one of their only two articles of clothing for security for this loan. The only type of person that would have used an article of clothing for security for a loan would have been a poor person. And they would have only had how many garments of clothing to their name? Only two. So the scenario is you have this wealthy individual who has far more than he needs for today, tomorrow, and the next day, who is exploiting someone who doesn't even have their common needs met today. He's hoarding more than what he needs for today, while someone whom today doesn't even have their common needs met, and tough times have come again, and now he's even suing this person for the one of the two articles of clothing. Does that guy need that article of clothing? No. Remember, this culture was founded by a God who said every 50 years, just cancel all the debts, let all the slaves free. Does he need what he's suing this poor person for? Absolutely not. This is what we call greed. If you agree with that, say yes. Now, another element to this cultural puzzle that we have to put on the table is that in this culture, and women, you'll understand this, Both men and women wore dresses. And ladies, when you wear a dress or a skirt, you have to act a little differently than when you're wearing pants. If you agree with that, let me see your hands. Yes. You ever heard the phrase, sit like a lady? I have two daughters. I've heard that from their mother a million times. You see, when everybody's wearing a dress or a skirt, the chances for immodesty are pretty high. There's going to be times where people's nakedness is accidentally exposed. And in this culture, the shame was not on the person whose nakedness was revealed. The shame was on the person who looked at that nakedness. How many remember the story of Noah and his son? Or the crime that his son committed was looking on his father's nakedness. And you remember the older two sons, when they came in to remedy the problem, they walked backwards, correct? And dropped a drapery over their father so as to not look upon their father's nakedness. In other words, the shame was on the person that looked on the nakedness, not on the person who was naked. Now take all of that together and watch what Jesus is saying. He is more radical. He is not as domesticated and conventional as we give him credit for. He's saying if they haul you into court and they're suing you for your chiton, your undergarment, and they're only going to leave you with your hemation, then you just strip down and give them the hemation as well. And I'm sorry, this was before the invention of Hanes and Fruit of the Loom. So what would that individual have been standing there in? Their birthday suit. That's correct. They would have been standing there in nothing, which was, in essence, in that culture, saying what? Shame on you. Now, was this resistance? Yes. Was it nonviolent resistance? Yes. See, and we don't like it. But Jesus is actually saying here that public nudity is a valid form of nonviolent non-cooperation. It makes us uncomfortable, doesn't it? All the hippies in the room are thankful right now. I'm telling you, Jesus is more radical than what our Sunday school and Sabbath school classes have allowed him to be. You have heard that, he says, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him what? Why does he use this example? Well, it's because Roman soldiers had the authority to commission Jews to carry the civilians, to carry their burden for 1 mile, but it was limited. If they made them carry it more than one, that soldier could be penalized by his superiors. He would be in trouble. And what Jesus is actually saying is, if they make you carry it one, when you get to the end of the one, don't give it back. Now, how many can see that's non-cooperation? Is it violent? So it's nonviolent non-cooperation. You got to imagine the Roman soldier begging this Jew, no, you got to give it back to me because I'll get in trouble. And the Jew saying, no, I'll vouch for you. If you get caught, I'll testify that I volunteered for this. This was of my own volition. And then you got to wonder, what kind of conversation went down during the second mile between this Roman and this Jew when this Roman knew the Jews hated him, but this Jew was different? How many can see it's a way to change the world? It's not pacifism, but it's nonviolent. And it's nonviolent non-cooperation with the way this world does things. You've had a paradigm shift tonight. Let me see your hands. Did you see something there? Yeah, Jesus is actually teaching us a way to stand up against the injustices that we see in this world, but at the same time, do it in a way that reflects the character of who God is. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you what? Love your enemies. That is at the core of his, because see, you'll remember, that's at the core of his nonviolent teaching. Because remember, Jesus in the cross, if you remember what was on the screen the other night, the enemies weren't the real ones that were crucifying him. The real enemy was the Satan, and they were just simply a conduit. And this is the means whereby through shame, shame was the weapon Jesus chose to use here, through shame, which is nonviolent non-cooperation, you're causing them to wake up to what they're doing and hopefully depart from the service of the enemy, embrace your humanity, and choose to follow Jesus with you. Can you see how it would begin to work? If you can see that, say yes. Two of you saw it. Great. We'll keep working on it. Look at John 18:36. Jesus said, my kingdom is what? Not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to, what's the word? Prevent. Now, was Jesus fighting at this moment? Yes, but not the way that we typically view fighting. He was not fighting violently. How many can see that? But was he fighting? Yes, the weapons of our warfare are not like the weapons that are. See, the early church they were fighting against the culture of their day. But how are they doing it? Through a sword or through a cross? Is the cross a weapon? It absolutely is. Now, it's not the kind of weapon that we typically think of, but it's nonviolent non-cooperation. Is that a way to fight against your enemies in the hopes of not only winning your cause, but winning your enemies with the cause? Do you remember what Martin Luther King Jr. said? He said, we will match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure that suffering. And in the end, we will win the double victory because we will not only win our freedom, but we will win you with it. Do you see the principle there? It is a weapon, but as a weapon that is not of this world. Luke 9, well, what about you? He asked, who do you say that I am? Peter answered, God's Messiah. And Jesus strictly warned them not to tell this to anyone. Why could they not tell to anyone that Jesus was the Messiah? Because what kind of Messiah, think about the words on the screen, what kind of Messiah were they looking for and hoping for and expecting? A violent one. And that is not what Jesus was all about. He says, the Son of Man must actually suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests, the teachers of the law. And he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Then he said to them, before we get to that, notice the point. Remember we talked about this the other night. We're just reviewing now. Step number one is provoke the injustice. Did Jesus do that in the cleansing of the temple? Provoke the system. Did the system respond violently? Did Jesus say, I must get them to respond violently? There must be some, I must be crucified. Did he say that here? Yes, this is how it works. I must be handed over to them and crucified. And then on the third day, what would he do? Be resurrected. But he doesn't say, and this is so incredibly beautiful, he doesn't pit this to the disciples as that which I'm doing instead of you. He actually turns to them and said, and whoever wants to be my disciple, they must deny themselves and take up their what? Cross daily. Now, when Jesus said this, you could have heard a pin drop in the room. Because a cross to them was not the religious symbol that it is for us today. The cross for us is a symbol of our assurance for heaven. The cross to them was the means whereby which Rome executed its enemies. And Jesus said, this is not your ticket to heaven. This is the way you're going to change the world. You want to overthrow the Romans? Don't do it by violence. Let me show you a third way, a better way, where we could actually win the Romans even to the kingdom of heaven. And was that the great hope of the Hebrew paradigm? Now, once again, we're not denying any of the other things. All we're saying is the picture we get of Jesus in the Gospels, he speaks very little about getting people to heaven and more about how we can bring heaven to earth. If you've seen that in this series, say yes. Take up your cross daily, whoever wants to save their life. How are they going to save their life? They were going to go up against Rome militaristically. He said, if you try that, you will lose your life. But whoever loses their life for me, if you follow what I'm teaching, you will, what does he say? You'll save it. Luke 22, when Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, Lord, should we strike with our swords? At least 11 of them asked. One of them didn't wait for an answer. One of them, John tells us it was Peter, he struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. That is the greatest tragedy of the entire gospel story. That, in a moment you'll see it. I just feel robbed by this. What was Peter doing? Was he pulling a Zorro where he's like, lift off the guy's ear? He just had skillful aim and he was just giving him a warning. Is that what Peter was doing? No, Peter is impulsive. Everything we know about him was that he was impulsive. He pulled out a sword, not waiting for the answer. And what is he trying to do with that sword? He's trying to decapitate the dude. The dude happens to duck, and it glances off the side of his head and just takes off his ear, which I feel robbed. That would have been the coolest miracle in the Jesus story. How many think that would have been cool? Yeah. Instead, we just get a little ear reattachment. Yeah. Anyway, takes off the guy's ear. Jesus answered, no more of this. And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple guard, why again was it the temple guard that was arresting him? Because what had he done just days previous? Cleansed the temple. He had provoked the system. It was the salt march. It was the freedom ride. It was the burning of the ripping up of the passports in South Africa. And he says, am I leading a rebellion that you've come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts and you didn't lay a hand on me. But this is the hour when what? Darkness reigns. Darkness must be allowed to show its character. And what will darkness use every time when it's revealing its character? What's the bottom word there? Violence. Matthew 26:52 adds this element to Luke's story. Jesus said, put your sword back in its place, Jesus said to him. For all who draw the sword will what? Die by the sword. Jesus here is attacking our binary thinking. In our binary thinking, we typically only see two ways. We assume that if we want to win, we must use violence. If we use not violence, we will lose. What Jesus is saying is you need to have a paradigm shift. Even those who use violence die by violence. He's saying violence doesn't always win, and nonviolence doesn't always lose. How many of you know of stories where nonviolence was actually used to accomplish great good on this planet, where they didn't lose? How many have heard stories like that before? Has anyone ever heard of the great Mahatma Gandhi? Did he accomplish great things through using nonviolent non-cooperation? Absolutely. And when Gandhi was asked, to what do you attribute to your success to? Do you know what Gandhi would say? He said, I've spent 2 years every day of my life meditating on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Who did Gandhi attribute his methods to? Where did he say he got them from? From Jesus, which is a little bit confrontational. When people would ask him to be a Christian, he would say, "I would be a Christian if I ever found one." What did he mean by that? He was surrounded by British Christians. What he meant by that was, when I find a Christian that's taking the teachings of Jesus and the Sermon on the Mount as seriously as I am, then I will become a Christian. Until then, I think I'm following Jesus more than you are. Today, that challenges our Americanized, Westernized version of Christianity that many times cheerleads more the empire and its violence than it does the kingdom of Christ trying to win the world through nonviolence. That's a different sermon. But what I want you to realize, I'm not saying violence always wins. I'm not saying it always loses. I'm not saying that pacifism always wins or that pacifism always loses. Both can win and both can lose. How many would agree with that? But we don't follow the peace teachings of Jesus because they always work. Sometimes you will end up on a cross. Wasn't that true for all the disciples and Jesus himself? We follow the peace teachings of Jesus because we're followers of Jesus. And that's what Jesus commanded. In Luke 22, some will raise this verse. Then Jesus asked them, "When I sent you without purse or bag or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Nothing," they answered. He said to them, "But now if you have purse, then take one and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one." I had someone recently say to me, see Herb, even Jesus told him to go buy swords. How many have heard that objection before to the peace teachings of Jesus? I'm not going to ask you how many have used it before. I'm going to ask you how many have heard it before. See, Jesus told him, go buy a sword. We can use swords. Again, a text without a context is a sure sign that you're being conned. I'm not going to a different place in the scriptures. I'm just asking you to keep reading the next two verses. It says, it is written, he was numbered with the transgressors. Again, the Greek word here for transgressor can mean political enemy, a rebel. You're being numbered with the rebels. This is not in the eyes of God. This is in the eyes of Rome. For Rome to get involved, what must the Jesus revolution, what must it be able to be accused of to Rome? Violent sedition. It must be numbered with the other political rebels for Rome to even... Otherwise, Pilate's going to say to the high priest Caiaphas and the others, this is your issue, you go deal with it. Did he try that? And he said, no. And what was their response? No, this guy claimed to be king, and if you don't do something, you're no friend of whose? Caesar's. That's why he said, keep reading. He must be numbered with the transgressors. I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment. The disciples said, see, Lord, here are two swords. What does Jesus say? That is enough. Enough for what? Enough for 12 men to use? Is two swords enough for 12 men to use? Is it enough for Rome to see weapons in their possession? Yes. How do we know that Jesus did not intend these two swords to be used? Because just a few hours later, it is one of these two swords that Peter pulls out and actually does use. And what does Jesus do? Rebukes him. And he says, that's not what I meant back there in the upper room. I didn't mean for you to use it. Put it away. No more of this. People have said this, Matthew 10:34. Some have raised this and said, do not suppose that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a what? A sword. See, Jesus came to bring a sword. Again, just look at the context. We're not going anywhere else. I just want you to keep reading the next three verses. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Enemies will be the members of your own household. Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And anyone who loves a son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take up their, what's that word? cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Yes, Jesus came to bring a sword, but in these scenarios, whose hand is the sword in? The Jesus follower or the person who's rejecting the Jesus follower for following Jesus? In other words, your enemies will be members of your own family. They will raise a sword against you. And if you want to be my disciple, then take up your, what does he say? Your cross in response to their sword. Had Jesus come to provoke the way life is done on this planet? Had he come, what does he mean, I've not come to bring peace but a sword? Had he come to just pat the world on the back and say, you're doing it right? Or had he come to challenge every way this world does, the political violence, the economy of oppression? Did he come to challenge all of that? Absolutely he did. And would that create a backlash? He came not to create peace, but a backlash, so that we could respond to that backlash with nonviolent non-cooperation. It's the way of the cross. I have to admit to you tonight that for years, as a Christian, I thought the cross was just the means whereby which God was trying to get me to go to heaven when I died. That's what I grew up with. But Jesus seems to be using the cross in a very different paradigm. It's the means by which God is trying to bring heaven to earth. Can you see it? If you can see it, say yes. You guys are the most quiet audience I've had in 2013. You will hold the trophy for this year. Look at in Matthew or Luke 14:23. Some have used this. Then the master told his servant, go out to the roads and the country lanes and compel them to come in so that my house may be full. Augustine said, he doesn't say how to compel them. He said, Augustine told us, it's okay to run your enemies through with a spear as long as you love them in your heart while you do it. We'll read about them in just a moment. Some have raised Romans 13:4, for the one in authority is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for the rulers do not bear the sword for no reason. They are God's what? Servants, agents of what? Wrath to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. See, they're God's servants. You can wield the sword and be a servant of God. Look at Romans 12, though. This is the context. Do not repay anyone what? Isn't that Matthew 5 again? Eye for eye, tooth for a tooth. Do not repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful. Do what is right in the eyes of everyone. And if it's possible, as far as it depends on you, if there is a sword produced by your following Jesus, may it not be your sword. Live at peace with what? Everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's what? What are they forbidden from participating in? God's wrath. Does God have servants that he's using to carry out that? And for a Jesus follower, we are not to cooperate with that. We are to leave a strict separation between following Jesus and the civil governments of our world. Do you understand the difference between those two? It's called a separation of church and state. He says, for it is written, it is mine to avenge. I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, this is how we're to respond. If your enemy is hungry, do what? Because you're not trying to obliterate your enemy, you're trying to win him. And if your enemy is hungry, thirsty, give him something to drink. In doing this, you will do what? Heap burning coals on his head. What is that? What are those burning coals? But remember when they stood there naked and when they turned the other cheek and when they went the second mile, what emotion were you inflicting on your enemies? Shame. Is shame a valid way to get people to wake up to the systems that they are cooperating with that is dehumanizing people Jesus died for? Is shame a valid option that Jesus gives us to use? Is lethal force, is killing them? No, because we're trying to win them, not obliterate them. The authorities that exist, he says, let's continue on. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with what? Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities. The authorities that exist have been established by God, yes. A librarian orchestrates all the books in the library. It doesn't mean the librarian agrees with what's in all the books. It says, for rulers hold no terror for those who do right, but for those who do what? They are God's servants, agents of to bring punishment on the wrongdoer. Therefore, it is necessary to submit to the authorities. This is why you what? What does he mean by submit? Does he mean do everything they say? It means pay your what? Taxes, for the authorities are God's servants who give their full time to governing. But again, what I find ironic, two things. One's a tangent, but I'll say it. Jesus doesn't say, pay your taxes if everything your tax money is going for is in accordance with the kingdom. It just says pay your... He doesn't say pay your taxes as long as you have representation. He says pay your... Which is incredible to me. A few years ago, the Patriot Bible came out from Nelson Publishers. And it said within the notes of the Patriot Bible, the number one Christian holiday, even above Christmas and Easter, the number one Christian holiday. Do you know what the Patriots Bible said it was? July 4th. July 4th. As if celebrating the victory in a war that was about not paying taxes because we weren't being represented. Whether that's right or wrong, the question is not whether it's right or wrong. The question is, does it look like Jesus? It's interesting where we're at today as Christians. The second thing I want you to notice here is that we don't pay our taxes again because we're Americans. We pay our taxes. This is what we covered last night. Because we're followers of who? And Jesus tells us as a part of his kingdom to pay the taxes to whatever kingdom of this world you find yourself an ambassador to. Look at Matthew 13. He told them another parable. This one's going to light up. Man, when I saw this, this one changed my life. This is going to light up your world tonight. He told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a what? A mustard seed, which a man took and planted in his field. Though it is the smallest of all seeds, yet when it is grown, it is the largest of the garden plants, and it becomes a tree, so that the birds come and perch in its branches. Now, it's going to take me a few minutes, and I don't want you to get lost. What we are talking about right now is, what did Jesus mean by this mustard seed? Today, we suffer from an emphasis in Christianity that has made everything individual. In other words, the mustard seed is how God changes you as an individual versus how God changes the world. We've suffered from it being about post-mortem. Everything that Jesus did was to accomplish post-mortem bliss rather than changing the world in the here and in the now. In the first century Christians, you do not find that emphasis. You find them more focused. You don't find them promising heaven and threatening hell. You find them calling people to follow Jesus to escape this present age and enter into the age to come, all right here. In this mustard seed principle, look in your notes section. I'll give it to you. For 300 years, the first 300 years of Christian history, these guys, the patristic fathers, the patristic writings, they could, the early church fathers, they could have, they disagreed on almost every topic, and they argued, and they disagreed on almost everything. But there was one subject they were all unified on. There was not one dissenting voice among the early church fathers for 300 years. Guess which topic it was? The one that we're talking about this evening. I want to read it to you from Origen. This is an early church father. He wrote in the 2nd and 3rd century. For we no longer take up sword against, what does it say? Nation, nor do we learn war anymore, having become children of what? Peace for the sake of who? Jesus, who is our leader. Origen writes again, and to those who inquire of us whence we come, where have you guys come from? You guys are so different. And who is our founder? We reply that we are come agreeably to the counsels of Jesus, to cut down our hostile and insolent wordy swords into plowshares, and to convert into pruning hooks the spears formerly employed in war. For we no longer take up sword against nation, nor do we learn war anymore, having become children of peace for the sake of Jesus, who is our leader. Tertullian writes, and shall the Son of Peace take part in the battle when it does not become him to even sue at law? And shall he apply the chain and the prison and the torture and the punishment, who is not the avenger even of his own wrongs? Arnobius writes, it makes no difference whether you put a man to death by word or rather by sword. And what he's talking about there, maybe you're a commander in the government and you're just commanding that people be, their lives be taken. He said, it doesn't matter, since it's the act of putting to death itself which is prohibited. Therefore, with regard to this precept of God, there ought to be, what does he say? No exception at all, but that it is always unlawful. How often? Always unlawful to put to death a man whom God willed to be a sacrosanct creature. Arnobius says again, rather it is better to suffer wrong than to inflict it. We would rather shed our own blood than stain our hands and our conscience with that of another. Hippolytus wrote, if anyone who has the power of the sword or who is a civil magistrate wearing the purple, they should desist or he should be what? What does that mean? You can't be part of the Jesus movement and still hold on to that. Now, the last one I want to share with you is Lactantius. And the reason Lactantius is important, this is the last early church father we see writing like this, with this voice. Lactantius was the tutor of Constantine's son. What do we know about Constantine? When Constantine became converted, so to speak, when he joined Christianity, I'm submitting to you this evening that Constantine's life didn't change in order to become a follower of Jesus. What following Jesus means changed to accommodate the Roman emperor joining them. Christianity overnight went from a persecuted minority to a persecuting majority. The peace teachings of Jesus particularly were marginalized by the early Christians, and the Christians of the fourth century. And what was set in motion was a trajectory which today we look back on, and history attests that there has been more blood shed in the name of Jesus than any other name in human history. How do you get that phenomenon from the nonviolent Jesus? Today, when the polls are taken, Christians today are actually rated as more prone to violence than non-Christians. God save us. When America goes to war, do you know who America's loudest cheerleaders are? White evangelical Americans here in the South. Early Christians would not have cheered Rome on in their war. They would have prayed. They wouldn't have cheered. And they wouldn't have just prayed for Rome's soldiers. They would have prayed for the enemy's soldiers too. Because did Jesus die for everyone? Yes, they would have prayed for peace. But notice what Lactantius says. God, in prohibiting killing, discountenances not only brigandage, which is contrary to human law. He is also recommending us not to do certain things which are treated as lawful among men. Thus, participation in war will not be legitimate for a just man. His military service is justice itself. In other words, pursue justice. What are the interests of our country but the inconveniences of another state or nation? That is, to the extent the boundaries which are violently taken from others to increase the power of the state, to improve the revenues of all which things are not virtues, but the overthrowing of virtues. For in the first place, the union of human society is taken away. Innocence is taken away. The abstaining from the poverty of another is taken away. Lastly, justice itself is taken away, which is unable to bear the tearing asunder of the human race wherever arms have glittered. The great Mahatma Gandhi said, I'm not opposed to violence because it doesn't work. He said, I'm opposed to violence because the good that it accomplishes is temporary, while the damage that it does is forever. Something for us to ponder today in our cultural setting. What does this mean? When Constantine, what was going on in Constantine's day? Why did he convert? What is this mustard seed principle really all about? Well, this is what Constantine began to realize. How do you defeat a movement? How do you defeat a revolution that defines failure as victory? Remember, when they slayed one Christian, 10 more popped up in his place. The blood of the martyrs was seed. Nero tried to crush it out through violence. Could he do it? No, it only made Christianity grow even more. Domitian tried to crush it out through violence. The next round of persecution through the Roman Empire. Could he do it? By the time you get to Constantine, Christianity is growing at such an exponential rate that even today, secular historians can't explain why it was happening that way. It was growing so fast, Constantine put two and two together. And I'm going to speak, this is an Adventist church, so I'm going to speak to the Adventists that are here tonight. If you're not an Adventist, that's okay. This will be for you too, but I want to, it used to be this way, I don't know if it is anymore, but when Adventists would be drafted into the service, they were much like the Mennonites and the others, the Anabaptists. They would go in as COs. What does that stand for? Conscientious objector. When Constantine began to see everybody becoming Christian, he realized that back then, being Christian was synonymous with being a pacifist, because you were following Jesus, the Prince of Peace. He realized that if everybody became Christian, what would that open the possibility up for Rome? If everybody becomes Christian, he said, then there will no longer be anyone to protect Rome's borders from its enemies. Was this a threat to the Roman Empire? Yes. And so, what did Constantine do? I believe he infiltrated Christianity and changed it from the inside out. But let's stop for a moment. Don't go into history. Let's play that scenario out. Let's be hypothetical. What would have happened if everybody would have become Christian, meaning pacifist, and Rome didn't have anyone to protect its borders? What would have happened? Then sure enough, it would have been taken over by its enemies. Is that right? Yes, let's call that Empire B. So Empire B takes over Rome, and Rome is no more, but who's still present in that territory? Christians. And are they still growing at an exponential rate? So after a time, what problems would Empire B be facing? Well, if everybody becomes a Christian, then we're subject to our enemies too. We're vulnerable to our enemies too. And let's say Empire C comes in, takes over that territory, wipes out Empire B. Empire B is no more, but who's still there in that territory? Christians. And would they have still continued to grow exponentially? Until finally, Empire C over time is facing the same dilemma Rome originally did, and they're taken over by Empire D. Can you reason that out to its furthest logical conclusion? At some stage, you run out of kingdoms of this world, and the last kingdom standing is the kingdom of our Lord and of His Christ. He is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, and Jesus has won, and He's done it all not by ever lifting a sword, but by His followers continually embracing a cross. How many wish that's the way human history would have gone? Now be honest, would a lot of Christians have died in that process? But that's what we were talking about the other night. They were dying in the hopes that this world would one day see a new day, that one day there'd be a new heaven and a new earth where Christ's kingdom reigned supreme, and the ways of violence and the ways that it set us on the trajectory of death, those would be done away with. Politics would be different. Economics would be different. They were dying for the hope of a world restored.
the world under the headship of Christ once again. And I'm submitting tonight that the mustard seed cannot, that principle cannot come true without Jesus' followers once again returning to the peace teachings of Jesus. We must come back home to the ethics that we were founded upon. It is the way to life. It is counterintuitive, I know. It doesn't sound like the way to life. Remember, I said Jesus would ruin your life. How many remember me saying that? It doesn't sound like the way to life. But even Jesus said, he who loses his life for me will find it. Those who seek to save your life, you will lose it. You find after Constantine these types of rhetoric. Jacques de Vitry, he writes, when people falsely assert that you are not allowed to take up the physical sword or fight bodily against the enemies of the church, it is the devil trying to attack the fabric of your order. In other words, if you follow Matthew 5, if you follow the Sermon on the Mount, you're actually inspired by the devil. That's what Christians started teaching. In John of Mantua, do not even be ashamed, O bride of heaven. Do not ever be ashamed, O bride of heaven, to take up the sword against heretics, for the God still lives who sanctified such actions through the arms of who? It is unacceptable for a Jesus follower, if you were here for the night of accommodations and ideal, it is unacceptable for a Jesus follower to reach back to the ethics of the Old Testament to give you an excuse to marginalize the ethics of the Sermon on the Mount. Pope Innocent, that's an ironic name, he wrote, bodily torture has been found the most salutary and effective means of leading to spiritual repentance. Augustine writes, war is waged to serve the peace. You must therefore be a peacemaker even to the waging of war so that by your conquest you may lead those who subdue the enjoyment of peace. That kind of logic sounds familiar, doesn't it? Look at what Augustine later wrote. What indeed is wrong with war? That people die who will eventually die anyway? So that those who survive may be subdued in peace? A coward complains of this, but it does not bother religious people. Augustine would be proud today. Does anyone doubt that it is preferable for people to be drawn to worship God by teaching rather than forced by fear of punishment or by pain? But because the one type is better, it does not mean that the others, who are not of that type, ought to be ignored. And I'll close that section with the words of Tullian so that you can just see the stark contrast. When Christ disarmed Peter, he disarmed every soldier. There's a huge difference in pre-Constantinian Christianity to what Christianity became after the Constantinian shift. Thomas Merton, if you know who that is, he writes this, Augustine, for better or for worse, is the father of all modern Christian thought on war. And you saw it there as we read Augustine's statements. You see, Constantine needed a new theology that would legitimize using violence in Jesus' name. And do you know who came up with that theology? Augustine. That's why we know the name Augustine. That was his rise to fame. But in this subject, Augustine has shaped more the thinking of Christians today than Jesus. And I'm submitting it is time to go back to being more than just a Christian, more than just someone on their way to post-mortem bliss. It's time to be a follower of that Jesus in the here and now as well. I want to talk to you a little bit tonight before we close this section about the fear of foreign threat. The fear of foreign threat is what is always used to discourage people from following Jesus. In Jesus' day, who was the foreign threat that they were afraid of? Rome. And so they chose not to practice the middle option, but to practice the bottom one. They were afraid that would allow Rome to just take over. In the 16th century, when the Anabaptists, which if you know anything about their history, they were the second Reformation. You had the Protestants, you had the Catholics, the Protestants, then the Anabaptists. And what the Anabaptists saw was the Protestants were no different than the Catholics, that they were now killing people over theological matters too at the stake, and they were practicing the same violence. And what they came to understand was that that which was abandoned in the time of Constantine was the Sermon on the Mount. And so they went back. They didn't have all their theology figured out, but they started practicing the ethics of Jesus. But this caused huge consternation in Europe. They believed that only adults could be baptized. They stopped infant baptism, and they started practicing the nonviolence of Jesus. And when they did this, this created fear among the Protestants. Do you know what argument the Protestants like Zwingli used to incite fear among the masses towards the Anabaptists? He said, if we follow what these Anabaptists say we should be following, he said, the Sermon on the Mount is not for everyone. That's just for monks. That's just for special people. Or Jesus didn't mean you to actually follow that. That's just to show you how much you need his grace. You can't do that. If we follow what these Anabaptists are teaching, he said, the Turks will overrun Europe. We're the Turks, the Muslims, the enemies of the East in the time of the Crusades. Again, what did Protestants use to discourage people from following the peace teachings of Jesus in the 16th century? Fear of foreign threat. So much so that they burned Anabaptists at the stake and drowned them in their rivers. People say, well, Herb, what about World War II and Hitler? Does that mean you just let Hitler walk all over the planet? Hear me. It's not the top word. Are you hearing what I'm saying? Do not combat the second word as if it's the same as the top word. Let me tell you a story of Metropolitan Kirill. He was the leader of the Christian church in Bulgaria during World War II, during Nazi rule. Hitler made a deal with Bulgaria to turn over all of their Jews. They said, Bulgaria lost certain territories in previous wars. We will give that territory back to you if you give us all of the Jews within the territory of Bulgaria. And so they struck the deal, and at 11 o'clock at night, the trains pulled up to the station. The SS soldiers got off with their machine guns, and they began to round up all of the Jewish people. Word got out, and one who received word was Metropolitan Kirill. He was the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church for Bulgaria, the head of the Christian church in that country. It says he was a 7'2" man. Can you imagine a guy that tall? And think about what he wore as a Eastern Orthodox priest. He wore a long black robe, he had a long white beard, and a little black hat. Can you imagine what a 7'2" man stepping out of the fog wearing that looked like that night at the train station? He gets word, he begins heading towards the train station. There's actually 300 parishioners with him. It says his stride is so large, so great, that his fellow parishioners have to run just to keep up with his walk. He finally gets to the train station. The SS soldiers point, they know who he is. They point their machine guns at him and they say, I'm sorry, Father, you can't come in here. The story says Metropolitan Kirill laughed at them. That takes guts. He laughed at them, brushed their machine guns aside, and he walks through the barbed wire enclosure onto the cart housing all the Jews. He walks onto one of those cars, train cars. And it's just packed with Jewish people. They're praying for a miracle. They know that if God doesn't do something, their next destination is Auschwitz. This is the last night of their life. And so they're praying for God to do something. And Metropolitan Kirill opens his mouth, speaks one word, and changes the fate of a nation. He reaches back into the history of the Jewish people itself, into a story that would have been so meaningful to them. And he quotes from the book of Ruth. He says these words, wherever thou goest, I will go. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. The Jews erupt. They begin to applaud. It creates a scene. More people begin to be attracted at the train station. They wrestle Metropolitan Kirill off the train car. They hustle. They try to pull him away, but he breaks free and he sprints to the front of the train and throws himself over the train tracks as if to say, if you want them, fine, you can have them, but you're going to have to roll over me to do it. Now, has he acted violently yet at all? No. They try to wrestle him off the train tracks, it says, for 3 hours. And finally, the way they finally got him off the train tracks was they open up the cars, and they let all of the Jews off the train. When the last Jew stepped off of the train, Metropolitan Kirill politely stood up, brushed himself off, and stood aside off of the tracks. That train left that night with not one Jew on it. And that train never came back again. And Bulgaria ended World War II. It was the only country under Nazi rule to end World War II with more Jews in its borders than what they had started with at the beginning of World War II. And Metropolitan Kirill, he's Eastern Orthodox, which means they believe they have a doctrine of the second option there. He would not kill his enemies, but he would not fail to embrace the way of the cross if that's what it took to stop them. I'm not saying it always works, but can you see tonight how it did work? And that's it. Was Hitler stopped through these methods? If you can see that, say yes. In that story, he was. Terrorism today, we've got to let it challenge us. That's the fear of foreign threat that everyone always... What about Al-Qaeda, Herb? Again, notice what's happening. The fear of foreign threat being used to discourage us from following the peace teachings of Jesus. And the last one that's used, and then we'll start just to wrap it up. The last one that's used is, well, Herb, what if someone breaks into your home? You're going to just pray for them? That's what people say. I want you to imagine this tonight. I want you to imagine I'm at home with my family. I'm home with my wife and my two youngest children, and we're seated there, maybe, you know, just spending some time together, and someone comes into the home with a gun and they're intended to do harm. Now, what's my first impulse? Be honest, what's my first impulse? My normal impulse. Yeah, grab a gun and shoot back, right? But let's say we get into a tussle instead, somehow. It's a hypothetical situation that most of us will never have to face. I know it does happen, but most of us won't ever face it, but let's be hypothetical. A tussle begins, and I pull the ski mask off of the perpetrator, and what I see in that moment is I look down into the eyes of my 16-year-old teenager. Will I still endeavor to stop her? You better believe it. I'm not going to go passive, am I? I'm still going to endeavor to stop her, but will the methods that I use to stop her now be different than if she were a stranger I didn't know? You see, when they're a stranger, the first thing we think of is lethal force. When it's our own children, the last option is lethal force. We try everything else first, hoping it never comes to that. All I'm submitting to you tonight is that every person who could potentially break into your home is the 16-year-old daughter of God. And it is time for us to begin even looking at people differently. That even they, once again, remember, are not our enemy. If it's got flesh and blood, it's not your enemy. They are a victim of the real enemy, and you are called to endeavor to save them as people Jesus died for from the real enemy just as much as you're saving the very ones that they're intending to do harm simultaneously. A friend of mine up in Canada, he's a pastor, he's a Brethren in Christ pastor, and they come from a Mennonite background, which is Anabaptist, which is a peace church as well, like Adventists, they're a peace church. And he's up there, and he's having a conversation one day on the street, and this African-American lady blazes past him, and he doesn't think much of it except for she's just really cooking. And then all of a sudden, these white skinheads follow after her. He drops his conversation, and he begins chasing after these white supremacists. And he doesn't know what he's going to do. He's thinking on the way, this is really stupid because I'm a pacifist. What am I going to do when I get there? But he shows up, he rounds the corner, and she is on the ground in fetal position, and they are kicking her with blows to kill. And he does the only thing he knows to do. He has stopped thinking at this moment, and he just acts out of instinct. He's a very large guy. He throws himself over top of this young girl, and he yells out two things, and he says they were the stupidest two things he probably could have ever said. But he didn't have time to think. He said, I'm a follower of Jesus, and so that means I can't do two things. And so they stopped kicking. He said, I'm a follower of Jesus, and so that means I can't do two things. I cannot let you kill this woman. He said, but I cannot fight you back. And they begin to argue with each other. What are you doing? You're a whitey. Why are you getting in the, get out of here, man? What are you doing? And they begin to argue. We're going to kill him too? No, we can't kill him too. And after a while, it started taking too long. And guess what happened? They all just dispersed. It's taking too long, man. They all just took off. Did he save her life? I so want you to understand, I'm not talking about pacifism. Our struggle is not against flesh and blood. 1 Corinthians says, it's the wrong verse, but it says, the weapons of our warfare are not like the world uses. And I know I could be wrong. I need one more volunteer. Could I ask you to come up once again, one last time, and this will be the last thing I share. Give him a hand as he's coming up, please, so that he feels comfortable with this. Now, I'm going to ask you, actually, come over here and stand over here. I'm going to ask you to do something, and I'm going to need you to really follow directions on this. Just do exactly what I say, all right? Put your hands out like this, okay? And I'm going to push against them, and I want you to try to push me across the stage, all right? I want you to try to push me across the stage, but it's really important that when I say stop, you actually stop, all right? Got it? Okay, let's try this. Okay, and really mean it, because I'm going to push you back, okay? Push. Okay, stop. Now, he's taller than me, he's bigger than me. This is the way most people are trying to combat violence on this planet today. If you can see that, say yes. They're trying to push back, and is it working very well? Now, there's another option. Try that again. Okay, go. Are there people just doing that? Which option is that on the screen? That's being passive. Is that working very well? There's even another option, and let's move over here so they can actually see this one because the podium's going to be in the way. Okay, go ahead and push again. What do we call that? That's called terrorism. Are you with me? It's a dirty way to fight, but are there people trying that today? Okay, one last time. There's one last option. All right? I know. I want you to do it one more time, all right? Thank you so much. Give him a hand. The last option is the way that Jesus calls us to try and change the world. Can you see it tonight? If you can, say yes. They say that if you don't hold in the back of your head that you could be wrong, then you're a fool. And I know I could be wrong tonight. But if I am wrong, I want to be wrong with people like Martin Luther King Jr. I want to be wrong with people like Dorothy Day. I want to be wrong with people like Gandhi. I want to be wrong with the Anabaptists of the 16th century. I want to be wrong with people like Claire and Francis of Assisi. I want to be wrong with the early church. I want to be wrong with Peter and Paul, James and Andrew. Most importantly, I want to be wrong with that guy named Jesus who was from Nazareth, who saw a better way. So we could be wrong, but I want to be wrong with him if I am wrong. And I'm calling you tonight to embrace the ethics of Jesus, to obey everything that he commanded us, because this world, once again, is set on a trajectory that ends in death. Violence only escalates. Have you seen it? There was a time when Christianity said the crossbow was an immoral weapon to use in a time of war. The crossbow. Today, we have means of destruction. We have enough firepower in the United States alone to wipe out every civilization on planet Earth 100 times over. And last year alone, we spent on that military-industrial complex, we spent 14 times the amount of what it would take to end world hunger forever Are you aware of that? Jesus gave us a way to heal the world. There is a way that seems right unto a man, but the end thereof is death. Follow Jesus. He's showing us a better way. We're going to break now for about 10 minutes. Enjoy your refreshments. If you haven't registered and you'd like a copy of the series, please do so. If you're a visitor, if you're a member, sorry. This is your gift to them. And again, thank you for being here. If you got questions, write those down. Put it in your question and answer box. And for those who are watching by video, that illustration I just used there at the end, I want to give a hat tip out to Jared McKenna, who I learned that from. If you'd like more information on this, see us at renewedheartministries.com, or you can check out some of the other websites there that are recommended. Thank you so much. God bless you guys. We'll see you in 10 minutes.